Well, let's begin, if we may, Michael. Just you don't need to close the door, but just put it ajar if it'll go that way. Welcome to everybody, and I'll just stand for the introduction. Thank you very much for coming to this meeting. I was slightly alarmed that the number of people on the table was going to exceed the number of people in the body of the Kirk. Typically, for a meeting in a Kirk, of course, we will fill up the back rows first. So, please feel able to participate fully in this conversation, which is to focus on the proposals that the profession, through a working party, which I have the privilege of chairing, has produced in relation to conflicts of interest. I'm going first, if I may, having thanked you for coming, to introduce the other members of the working party who were here with me. And in fact, I'll ask them to introduce themselves, starting with on my far right, your left.
I'm Charles Cowling, and I am from JLT, and I'm a pensions actuary.
Douglas Morrison, was profits actuary at Standard Life, so I've been trying to make sure the pensions actuaries don't just get it all their own way, and that we do look out for any kind of specific points on life practice as well.
Yes, so counter to that, I'm Graham Evans. I'm pensions actuary from Towers Watson.
And I'm Philip Moore, I'm the chairman of PREC and of the Working Party.
Good afternoon, I'm Ben Kemp. I'm not an actuary, I'm a solicitor and acting general counsel at the actuarial profession.
And I'm Alan Watson, I'm not on the working party, but I'm chairman of the Standards Review Committee, so all these sort of standards things come via me. So I got roped in as a volunteer.
Good. Okay, well, up there on the board we've put an indication of the sort of format of the consultation meeting that we propose. I'm going to give a very brief introduction to the working party's proposals. We will then move through a discussion of the different elements in the package that the working parties put forward. Don't be alarmed by all the timings up there. We're in your hands as regards time. We won't let this run for any longer than you want it to, because the object of the exercise is to explain the proposals to you in response to any questions that you might have about them, and crucially to hear your views on the proposals. We'll structure the discussion as we move on around the questions that are in the survey attached to the consultation paper at Appendix 8. It's also, of course, the survey that's online for to which members have been invited to respond. In short, please feel free to ask questions as we go along, and I will break up the conversation to focus on different elements in the package so you can register your points in relation to those elements as we proceed. It would be helpful, of course, if in order to enable us to understand the background from which you're asking your questions, if you would say who you are and where you come from or in what context you practice as we proceed. I think we probably will not need a hand mic, though we have one. There's a gentleman at the back who's doing a wonderful job for us.
Just because it's being recorded.
Right. Okay, well, if you Michael will as he's only got to pass it along a line, as it were, we'll pass the hand mic so that your comments can be recorded for posterity and any others who may be interested in picking up the recording of the session that will be on the website. Okay, by way of introduction to this evening, and now a brief introduction to the working party's proposals. In short, the issue of conflicts of interest in relation to the work of actuaries has been around for a long time. And it's proved a difficult issue over the years for the profession. You will all know that it achieved particular focus in the context of the Morris Report in 2005. And, of course, it's been referred to in a number of subsequent reports by the Professional Oversight Board. And I'm delighted that John Thorne from the board is here listening to today's consultation meeting. And other representatives of the board were present at the similar consultation meeting a week ago in London. So welcome, John, to you. We have proceeded initially by producing a discussion paper, trying to identify the key issues for the working party to address. And we issued that to the profession and to other interested parties outside the profession. And we received well over 300 responses from members of the profession to that initial discussion paper, as well as additional responses from the Oversight Board, other key players like the FSA and so on, and some users of actuarial services, though we were disappointed, frankly, in the response we had at that stage from users of actuarial services. However, we then engaged in a series of bilateral meetings in order to try to pick up more of the user voice. And so we met, for example, bodies like the National Association of Pension Funds. And, of course, we have spoken to the Actuarial Users Committee of the Financial Reporting Council about the proposals in order to get a balance of views from both from members and from those outside the profession who are using actuaries' advice. The feedback that we had to the discussion paper suggested that A, actuaries encounter conflicts a lot in their work, but B, for the most part, conflicts are well managed and handled. That feedback was uniformly consistent from users of actuarial services as well as from actuaries themselves. However, it was clear that there is still concern about a number of perceived risks in relation to conflicts, especially in terms of the work done by pensions actuaries. With a view to trying to address that, we have produced the proposals that are before you this evening.
Can I ask questions that go through?
Could you say who you are?
I'm Arthur Ziegelman. I work with Towers Watson. So
right, yeah.
You say there's concern, despite the fact that you previously, immediately prior, you said sort of conflict is met but well handled. My question is, from whom is this concern coming?
Some of the concern comes from users, some comes from external regulators, and some of it comes from actuaries themselves. What I said was that most of the conflicts, according to the responses that we have, are well handled. That implies that there's a minority that aren't as well handled as they might be. There's also an important distinction between an important issue which the working parties had to face in relation not only to the reality of how conflicts are handled, but also public perception of the possibility of conflict. It may well be argued that the perception of the possibility of conflict is being heightened at the moment because of the pressure on direct benefit schemes and so on. That's the best clarification I can give to in response to your question. Faced with this, we had three options really. One was to do nothing, to recommend no change in the current arrangements. The second was to impose, as a number urged, a ban on dual appointments, a complete ban, that is, on a person acting both as scheme actuary and offering any advice or services at all to a pension scheme funder, an employer. Or the third was to try to go for a targeted and proportionate approach, and that's what we've tried to do. We've tried to trim our proposals to actually meet and tackle the key areas of risk without being disproportionate in terms of introducing a complete ban on dual appointments. We've come up with a package of proposals. That's the other point I'd want to emphasise in this introduction. It's not just one strand, but a number of separate strands which interrelate to form a comprehensive package. They nestle under the overarching requirements of the Actuaries Code, about which a little bit more later in our discussion. We propose that the conflicts of interest provisions in the code should be supplemented by specific provisions in relation to life actuaries. Those have already been introduced through APSL 1, which was came into force at the beginning of this month, the 1st of October, and through amendments to APSP 1, which are the pensions provisions, which we'll come on to discuss in a minute. But we also propose, in addition to that regulatory provision, those hard regulatory provisions, if you like, the production of guidance for actuaries and for pension scheme trustees, and of course the provision of additional professional support for actuaries, because a strong emphasis, a strong sort of message from all the people we consulted was around a desire to have more in the way of help and guidance in terms of identifying conflicts, assessing what to do about them, and then managing them through to avoid any continuing problems. So that's the broad shape of the package and the thinking that underlies the package in its broad terms. And I'm going to pause at that point to ask if there are any further, we've had one already, question about the broad scope before we get into a specific discussion about APSP 1, which is where I think most interest is likely to focus. No? Okay, should we move into APSP 1? Ilona, whose finger is on the slide button, will flash up the text of APSP 1, and specifically of paragraph 5.1, which is the key provision which provides that a scheme actuary must not advise the employer to the scheme in relation to the funding of the scheme or any matter which has a direct bearing on the benefits payable under that scheme. And that's the critical provision in terms of this proposed APS P1 amendment. As I say, it reflects the working party's view that a targeted and proportionate response was appropriate rather than going for a complete ban. The aim was to deal with those areas where there's the highest both risk and perception of risk around the possibility of a conflict is in relation to issues to do with funding and factors underpinning the benefits payable by a scheme, without going as far as an outright ban on dual appointments. I'll pause at that point to allow discussion and questions and comments on APSP 1 and 5.1 in particular.
Good evening. Name's Alan Martin, a pension scheme actuary, but perhaps more importantly, much more an independent trustee these days. Just to pick up, the actuarial profession has historically and in structure regulated individuals, but here we have an issue of a scheme actuary, potentially an individual within a much larger organisation, perhaps with a senior partner, chief executive, very experienced, potentially intimidating, promotion determining individual, and I just wondered the extent to which regulation was considered at both the individual and the corporate level or firm entity level.
Are you, when you talk about the firm entity level, what's the focus of the concern that you've got? Sorry, I'm not sure I've fully understood it. I'll invite colleagues to.
It is very much from the perception level that a scheme actuary looking after the trustee's position would not be under this proposal in any way connected with the senior partner or chief executive who happens to be advising the conglomerate which owns this particular company. So it's more the independence at company or organisation level rather than at individual actuary level.
This is 5.3, isn't it?
Which yes, is I think the answer is it has certainly been considered. The actuary's code obviously is overriding, so it means that if the scheme actually felt that he was in a position of conflict as a result of the fact that the
one of his senior colleagues, the promotion determining senior colleague, advised the employer, then that may be under the actuary's code an irreconcilable conflict, depending on how it's actually handled. And there is, as I think Philip's pointing out there, 5.3, which we'll probably get onto later, there is a provision which does kind of require consideration to be given by scheme actuaries where somebody else in their firm is advising the employer. So, it's been touched upon, but it wasn't considered appropriate to go to the same extent where that was the case as where one individual was involved in both. Is that okay?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I would say slightly further than that. I thought we did actually consider, as a committee, we did consider it in quite some detail. We looked at all the options of where the lines could be drawn in different ways, and we did seriously debate should we prohibit at a firm level as well as an individual level. And it comes back to Philip's comments about what we thought was proportionate in the circumstances. So, yes, we did consider it in quite some detail.
If I might just add a bit of factual and a couple of factual points. I mean, the National Association of Pension Funds, for example, with whom we discussed this specifically, was pretty relaxed on the basis that their perception was that firms handle these matters well. The key consideration from their point of view and from the position in which the working party ended up was that we must ensure transparency, that transparency is the key thing, in order to enable pension trustees then to make the appropriate arrangements for handling any potential for conflict. So that putting the actuary, as 5.3 does, under an obligation to bring to the trustees' attention any conflict of which they're aware or potential conflict of which they're aware was viewed by the people we consulted as a proportionate response to the problem.
Okay. Just a corollary to that, other stakeholder, perhaps the pensions regulator, some of us here may already be getting those telephone calls from the regulator where we're grilled in trustee knowledge and understanding, conflicts of interest and employer covenant, but at least we've got lots of independence and transparency in employer covenant. Now, my fear is maybe in 5 years' time, if there is a scheme actuary and a company actuary within the one firm, that we are just going to be 5 years behind where the regulator might perceive problems to be when somebody is debating who's winning this issue, and is that falling for the corporate or the trustees?
We've taken evidence and views from the pensions regulator in the course of our inquiries and prior to the preparation of the consultation document. We didn't have advice from the pensions regulator of the strength that you are implying, which would have led to the conclusion that you were indicating. That doesn't appear to be the pensions regulator's position. They're not asking the profession to prevent a firm from advising both parties. Some actuarial firms, of course, including a number whose views we've collected in the course of our work, impose as a matter of company or commercial policy, if you like, such a ban. But that was not urged on us by the pensions regulator. Now, who knows what the position will be in 5 years' time, but it's not the current perception, as we understand it, of the regulator. Ben?
Thanks, Philip. I'm very interested in the question. Was there a suggestion, I may have misunderstood, was there a suggestion in the question that the lack of more strong provision in relation to the corporate entity might in some way pose some sort of difficulty for the scheme actuary in terms of his or her relationship with the corporate entity and senior people within the corporate body? Or did it?
Well, I think it's possible that senior partners or chief actuarial, chief actuarial officers there, they do understand conflicts, but just call it the boss could prevail upon the junior independent thinking actuary where the circumstances so dictate. But it was much more the element of sometimes it's not the realities that matter, it's the perceptions,
that
matter.
Yeah.
And if it is perceived that the scheme actuary is secondary to the bigger corporate advisor, somebody senior within the firm, then that could be as damaging.
Do you want to comment on this at all, Graham?
Well, we did consider a number of those exact issues, and it comes back to what is proportionate and in the circumstances, and an issue of transparency and ensuring that, you know, there is a certain reliance on professionals' integrity to highlight to trustees where these conflicts exist, and 5.3 highlights it. I would also mention that there's also one or two basic practical issues that we might do more to highlight. So, for example, if you have got the same firm advising the corporate entity and the trustees, you've got issues like house views on assumptions, and to what extent knowing where the other person is coming from, because you're in the same overall entity, does actually affect how you therefore might advise and negotiate. All of these things have been included in our discussions and our thinking, and you know, one of the things that we might take from this is where you think we should give more guidance in terms of practical examples and CPD and stuff to actuaries to ensure that they follow not just the letter of APSP 1, but actually the intention behind it.
Colleague from Towers Watson.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm coming from a very different world from Alan in this one, in the sense, you know, I work for Towers Watson, as lots of work for big organisations. We've got lots of people advising corporates on lots of things. It just wouldn't be practical if part of our conflict code was we're not allowed to advise on sort of the whole range of stuff that we do. I mean, just from and I know the faculty and institute are not interested in commercial, but from a purely commercial and professional perspective, it just wouldn't work. But going back to 5.1, I'm not sure I totally understand what I would be allowed to do as a scheme actuary, not allowed to do in the sense of the concept of advice. You know, can I give information to the employer? Because, I mean, I'm certainly guilty of that. I don't think it conflicts me, but if the employer asks, you know, what's the impact of changing the accrual rate from a 60th to an 80th, I can answer that question, or I feel I can answer that question. But I don't think that's advice in that sense. You talked about sort of individual factors. Well, lots of the individual factors are agreed between the company and the trustee. I'm quite comfortable with the funding issue. I mean, I think sort of in the funding issue, then you have to be entirely independent. But some of the other peripheral issues are key issues. You know, this whole issue about scheme design. I've always had a problem with this concept that the scheme actually isn't allowed to talk about scheme design, and give you lots of examples where sort of I've operated on the basis of a non-conflicting piece of advice to, or piece of information to the employer, not advising them to do it or not. So it's just actually, I mean, perceptions are important, but the reality is we have to have something here that we can actually deliver as a profession. And you can change perceptions, and you can change perceptions and educate people both within and outside the profession. And I don't subscribe to this argument because there is a perception there you have to do something dramatic and drastic to it. I think we have to consider sort of the whole thing on balance. And I mean, a really great example of that was the Miners Code. Miners published his code and then said something along the lines of, actuarial and investment advice should be subject to separate contracts. And then for 5 years, we had people saying you can't have the same actuary, same firm giving actuarial and investment advice, which is clearly not what was said. But I mean, it's a case where the perception was driving, I think, the wrong outcome. So I do think we need to be quite careful about this. And we're not at the sort of the trustees' guidance yet. And a number of issues about some of the examples in the trustees' guidance, which I think can be misinterpreted.
Well, we value your help in getting the words and the guidance and the guidance right, and we're going to come on to discuss that. I'll ask Graham just to talk a moment about your first point, which was a critical one, I think, and was certainly echoed in the consultation meeting in London, which was around the distinction between information on the one hand and advice on the other. And I think that is an issue which the Working Party will want to think further about in the light of the responses that we've had so far to the consultation paper. I don't know, Graham, if you want to comment on that at all or just note it, for the moment.
Well, we'll certainly note it, but I think we're going one way or another to have to clarify whether in the guidance or in something else to make sure that people understand what's meant by advice if we go ahead with it. So that's accepted, that's an area that will need some clarification. I think so not everyone will necessarily see it the same way, which might in itself say a tale, so people can come in differently if they think differently. But I see it primarily in terms of the having two clients issue as opposed to giving information, shall we say. So it is certainly, I see there were some people at the other meeting who were sort of saying, well, I can't even be in the same room as the employer because he might get all sorts of bits of information from me. And that is undoubtedly, in no way is that the intention, that you can never actually be in the same room as the employer and speak so the employer can hear anything, if the employer is not a client. But what I think we're trying to get at here is that you can't really be serving two masters where their interests are in conflict, which is the general principle of the Actuaries' Code. But then what does it actually mean in relation to pension scheme, certain aspects of pension scheme advice? And I think the feeling was that when funding and factor stroke benefits in the broadest sense, we can talk about some whether there ought to be any detailed exceptions in a minute, but in terms of generally on funding and benefits related stuff, there is far too much scope for conflict of interest for you actually to be serving both the trustees and the employer as people giving advice and as clients. That doesn't necessarily stop you providing information, which is in a sense is almost being passed on. It's sort of information, whether it's actually physically the case that it might be something that you give to the trustees and then it gets to the employer. You're obviously wanting to say something else.
You made the comment sort of there's a fundamental conflict between the employer and the trustee. The world I live in, that's not the case. And I hear myself saying that the interests are aligned. There may be conflict in sort of the process to actually get there. I cannot accept there's a fundamental conflict between the trustee and the employer in providing benefits in a final salary pension plan. I just can't accept that. And if that's where we start from, then I'm never going to agree with the conclusions.
All I would comment on that is that, of course, one of the ways in which, and we were about to come on to 5.2, in which the proposals recommend the proposals envisage that these things can be handled is by having an agreed written plan, which the trustees and the employer and everybody's party to, so everybody knows the rules of the game. And that, of course, would include clarity around what information can be passed on to the employer and what can't, and so on and so forth. I wonder, we need a fresh voice.
Ask another question before we move on.
Did you say who you are first?
Roger McNichol, pensions actuary.
Thank you.
Picking up on Alan's point where he raised the possibility of the scheme actuary being intimidated by his employer or a senior member of within his employer. He was talking, I think, about a consultancy environment where it's very unlikely that a direct conflict of interest would exist between a consultancy as an entity and the pension scheme trustees. Did the group, however, consider the different environment where the provider of services, the provider of the scheme actuary, the provider of the investment vehicle was the same, namely an insurance company, so that the scheme actuary was advising trustees but was being paid by the insurance company and the insurance company was providing the investment vehicle? Because in that circumstance, a direct conflict could arise. Was that considered at all?
Can I ask for an
well, it was on the list of issues of potential conflicts. Whether we considered it in as much detail as some of the others, no, because you're almost into the fundamental conflict between any consultant and their client, that you're being paid ultimately by a client who wants to hear the advice that they want. And you could extract what you've just said to almost every single consultancy type arrangement. So, yes, it was on our list of potential conflicts. I don't think we concluded that there was anything more that we should do to address the particular conflict you mentioned, but we're open to suggestions, I think, is how
I simply felt that there was a potential difference there, because the scheme actuary employed by a consultancy is unlikely at any point truly to be representing his employer and acting in the interests of his employer. He's going to be independent. That's not necessarily the case within an actuary employed by an insurance company, who will on occasion be representing his employer.
The critical factor in relation to the kind of situation you've described, which applies to all actuaries, is the provision of the relevant provision in the actuary's code. I'm just going to ask Ben Kemp to amplify that point.
Thank you, Philip. So I suppose where we get to is that there is a specific prohibition 5.1 in relation to a particular scenario. The view to date is that other scenarios, including the one you mention, subject to this consultation, do not merit that level of specific prohibition. But all considered, all such situations considered within the overarching provision of the Actuaries Code, which says that members will ensure that their ability to provide objective advice to their clients is not and cannot reasonably be seen to be compromised. What I'm wondering is whether you're calling for some sort of equivalent provision in relation to that situation as 5.1, or actually what you're calling for is some thought in relation to guidance about in relation to that sort of situation, whether that's another situation which we should be considering in
the context of guidance, having
regard to the overarching provision in the code. I could see that.
It would be right that is an example of a conflict that could have been included in that guide. It wasn't.
Yes.
They probably have various
which
examples.
Is a helpful,
there's a long list of ones. But in terms of the APSP mm-hmm. one, that is actually addressing only one type of conflict, and that's a client-on-client conflict, mm-hmm. and it's pension scheme trustee and the employer is the same one. So it's not even two trustee clients, for example. Mm-hmm. So it is a very narrow application in terms of only focusing on one specific conflict area. Whereas the guide is much more generic, and maybe there is a gap that you've identified there.
Roger, if you've got a suggestion, I'm not asking for it now, but I mean, if you've got a specific suggestion, or an illustrative a way of illustrating this, then it'd be very helpful to if you can bang an email in, which just would enable us to make sure that we adjust, and improve the draft guide, for example, to cover this kind of point. It would be...
Sure, I can very happily provide an illustration, yes.
Okay. I hope it all doesn't mean that the happiness in providing the illustration doesn't mean you're constantly being beaten over the head in an insurance company.
No, I've never worked as a scheme actuary for an insurance company.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Further points on APS... P1 and 5.1 in particular, the proposed amendment at 5.1. What I've got is a strong view from one person present that this is, at the very least needs clarifying considerably, and you're worried might go too far. On the other hand, I've got some indication, I think, that some people are not sure it goes far enough. I think that's what I got. Was that the implication of your points?
Yes.
Yes, I thought it was. And I've got a specific proposal in relation to in the insurance example. Sir?
Ian Campbell, pensions actuary with Spence & Partners. I think I'm with Arthur on 5.1. It seems to me that in many pension schemes, 5.1 is far too tight in what's happened in practice, where there perhaps has been conflict, but it's been managed quite well. I think there are lots of cases where there would be conflict which isn't managed well. And I just wonder if there is a form of words which isn't quite so tight, which deals with schemes where conflict is well managed. Was that thought through by the committee?
Well, we tried to think through all sorts of scenarios, but what we will do is take your question, and we will certainly reflect on it in the light of all the other comments that we've got in these consultation meetings and through the consultation process as a whole. I mean, we're trying to strike a balance here between ensuring protection where that is clearly justified and required indeed for the public interest, and on the other hand, producing a provision which is capable of easy application by actuaries who are dealing with live situations of varying sorts. So any help we can get in seeing our way through this is gratefully received. Now I'm going to move off 5.1. This is your last comment on it, I think, only in the interest of time.
Just adding one point, sort of. I mean, what worries me is this particular reference to the benefits payable under the scheme, including but not limited to the actuarial factors. Yeah. I mean, the benefits payable under the scheme, to the extent that they have been built up, are protected by legislation. So the scheme actuary sort of, you know, there's a statutory duty in everyone in that. And similarly, sort of the actuarial factors, to the extent that they apply to the benefits built up in the scheme, are subject to legislation, you know, the preservation legislation, etc., etc. Lots of the other factors are then defined by the trust deed and rules, and it gives authority to whomever it gives authority to determine them. So I just think the interaction of that statement and sort of the other legislation that manages the way pension schemes are operated just needs to, a little bit of thought. That's really, I mean, I don't have a problem with funding, and I don't have a problem with avoiding conflicts. It's a wording that slightly gets me there.
Okay. Right. That's helpful. That's very helpful. Thank you. Can we move on to 5.2? And essentially what 5.2 does is to amplify the scheme actuary's obligations under the code. The specific provisions, which are sort of, that's the first part of 5.2, and that's the, there you are, that's the rest of it. What they, in fact, the various provisions within it, the 4 points are essentially Morris recommendations. They encapsulate what Morris Review recommended. And in so doing, provide a definitive response to that recommendation in the Morris report. I had no criticism. We had no criticism of that at the London meeting. People were, thought it was a good thing. Yeah. Okay. I see nods. In that case, let's move on. 5.3 the next thing we'll move to, which is the point that we touched on earlier around potential conflicts of interest arising from the activities of other people in the same firm as the scheme actuary. And essentially it's on it's about transparency and disclosure, that if the scheme actuary is aware of an actual conflict or a potential conflict, then he is under an obligation, or he or she is under an obligation to ensure that the trustees are made aware of that. Any comments on 5.3? Alan?
Just Alan, just in the practical situation, some groups of trustees are, some trustees, given what their trustee rules say, are very dependent on scheme actuaries' advice, and I think there is a danger of that perception of a senior person to that scheme actuary influencing, and equally trustees can be intimidated, advisors intimidated. The fact of life is that such things can occur. And indeed very easily, not just perceived, but do unfortunately occur. So I think we need the structure right before getting down to the detail too much. So I would be an advocate of principles. But I do think there is a problem for trustees as well in a similar way.
Yeah, well, we've tried to set out a principle there, which is a principle of disclosure, essentially. And the working party certainly discussed the extent and range of conflicts within the trustee body, which we believe actually to be more serious in many ways than conflicts relating to an actuary. And it's because of concern around the conflicts within a trustee body that we have, in part because of that concern, that we developed this guide for trustees, which I'll explain more fully in, as we get on in this meeting. So your point about the tensions within the trustee body and the actuary's position in relation to them was well taken. On the thing about the point that you've made about actuaries being subject to pressure themselves from other people more senior to them within the firm, this is an issue which might arise in a number of contexts, of course, not just in the context of pensions. And it's an issue which we are trying to tackle through a variety of different means. It's extremely difficult to get at, but it's the reason why the Professional Oversight Board keeps, and we fully accept this, emphasising the importance of the working environment for actuaries as a key factor in determining actuarial performance and quality and behaviour. One of the ways in which, and a separate strand of activity within the profession, we're trying to get at that is by building a better relationship with firms, and we have some proposals for partnering with firms, which we're in the process of developing. But it's not easy to get at those pressures, is it? We hope that the principle that we've enunciated is an important part of getting at the pressures. And of course it sits within the overall principle, the overarching principles of the Actuaries Code.
Sorry, can I just ask?
You want to make a point on the other side, perhaps, of the argument?
I just want to understand what we're being asked to do here. And I'll give you an example. If I'm a scheme actuary to a fund, and my firm advises the remuneration committee on the reward mechanism for one of the senior executives who happens to be a trustee of the fund. Now, I can disclose that that sort of the firm advises the remuneration committee, but I'm not sure what you mean by conflicts of interest that may result or might potentially arise. I mean, in theory, if you're advising the sort of chairman of the trustees or the remuneration committee on what the chairman of the trustees might well get paid for his day job, you know, potentially there's a conflict there between the firm's role there and the scheme actuary. So I think it would be clear to me if this was a disclosure requirement of other work that you do, other work that your firm does, rather than necessarily ensuring the trustees are aware of potential conflicts of interest from that. I'm just not sure, you know, how I would satisfy that.
Ben?
But it's a very helpful point. My own reaction is that other members of the panel think, that it is just, as you say, actually, it's a disclosure requirement in relation to other relationships, particularly that you know other members of your firm have, which could potentially give rise to conflict.
Uncomfortable, yeah.
It's not asking you to speculate as to the particular scenarios which might arise, which might give rise to particular conflict. It's disclosing those relationships, I think.
Yes, and don't forget that a key consideration in the drafting of any standards, as in the drafting of any legal provision, is the concept of reasonableness.
Yes.
Okay. You cannot be expected to do something that you cannot reasonably be expected to do. And therefore, providing, you know, speculating about possible conflicts to the nth degree, it would not pass a test of reasonableness. And I mean, that's simply one example of the importance of holding on to this notion that it's the judgment always, you know, the test is always what the reasonable individual could be expected to do in situation A or B. Okay, actuaries are brilliant people, but they are not wizards. They are not soothsayers. They cannot predict the future, although in fact their little strap lines suggest that they might be able to.
So, I mean, to take at a very basic level, if you being approached by trustees to be the scheme actuary, and you're aware that a colleague with whom you're connected professionally is in your firm is providing corporate advice at some level to the employer, then I'd have thought that is something you ought to disclose in terms of this provision.
Oh yeah, I'm entirely happy with the disclosure. Just the wording of it again, I thought was pushing us further down.
I take that, and perhaps we can have a look at that. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. Point.
Okay, shall we move on to 5.4? That's purely a transitional provision, and I think, you know, I mean, we'll take any practical, any comments anybody wants to make from a practical point of view, but we're just trying to make sure that we introduce this in a sensible way. And perhaps we could then move on, okay, not having received any comments on that, to paragraph 6.4.1. And essentially what paragraph 6 is, paragraph 6.4 is doing is extending the application of section 5 of the draft standard to other people in positions akin to the scheme actuary who are giving similar advice of a significant nature in relation to the funding of a scheme. Any comments on 6.4.1? Well, what this is trying to do, in short, is to catch people who are in a situation akin, they're not formally the scheme actuary, but they're in a situation akin to the scheme actuary in terms of the advice that they provide, while excluding people who are, you know, doing simple number crunching or whatever, i.e. they are not providing advice at that level or of that character.
I think it's a bit more than that, actually, to be fair. I think 6.4.2 is often about the akin to scheme actuary role in non-relevant schemes. 6.4.1 is a bit wider, and the scheme actuary is number 2, for example, if he's significantly involved in giving the advice, would also be covered. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's again trying to be principled. Mm-hmm. If you're making this provision in relation to the scheme actuary, of course there's a particular importance around that statutory role, but it could in principle be rather undermined if there's somebody who's the deputy in a position which would be infringing 5.1 if he were the scheme actuary.
Shall we move on to 6.4.2 since it's been mentioned? Okay. Section 6.4.2 applies section 5 to pension schemes other than those which are required to appoint a scheme actuary. And it extends section 5 to members advising in the context of any other type of scheme which satisfies 4 criteria. Now, the critical point there is that what's source for the goose is source for the gander. We're trying to cover schemes, essentially, which aren't formally ones where there is a requirement to appoint a scheme actuary, but where the essential purpose and features of the scheme are, you know, on all fours with a scheme actuary scheme. This is essentially public sector provision.
Or it could be overseas schemes as well, actually. It
could be overseas, non-UK schemes in some context.
What we've tried to do is to resist the probably impossible task of listing the types of scheme we might have in mind, and again to take a principled approach, and interested particularly, I suppose, in any comments as to whether those principles are appropriately positioned, which is was a subject of very careful debate amongst the working party.
Looks good enough, I think, from the nods I'm getting around the room. Okay. And then the other point that we need to make in relation to APSP 1 is that it would be applicable to all members of the profession, including students, and that because students, of course, some of them may have been students for a number of years, be quite experienced, and doing work on pension schemes of a quite a significant nature. Okay, nods in agreement to that. Right, I'm going to deal rather more briefly with the guides for trustees and for actuaries, starting with the guide for actuaries. The I mentioned in my introductory remarks the strong emphasis and demand there have been for more guidance and help for members on identifying and assessing and resolving conflicts. So hence the two draft guides that we've produced, and in particular the guide, of course, for actuaries, which is modelled on the successful guides that we've produced for whistleblowing, one of which was sort of directed at actuaries and the other at employers of actuaries. We are we are keen. I'm not expecting to get detailed comments on the draft guides tonight, okay? But we're keen if there are any features of them which with which you are not happy, or having, you know, once you've read through them where you think that things can be improved, we're keen to have feedback from you. You know, Roger picked up a point or mentioned a point which is potentially of application there. In an earlier part of our discussion. The guide for trustees we have developed in discussion with the pensions regulator. Why are we doing that? Why on earth are we thinking at all about producing a guide for trustees? Well, first, because we're conscious of the point that Alan made earlier about the position, the potentially conflicted position of trustees, also because we're very keen that trustees should understand the context in which the actuary has to work and the expectations, professional and otherwise, that their actuary is under, the scheme actuary is under. And we hope that production of the guide for trustees gives the scheme actuary a useful tool in terms of handling his or her relationship with the trustee body. So we will welcome comments on the two drafts, and I should start with the guide for actuaries and just see if anybody wants to offer any comment on that. We can flash up a couple of the consultation questions, which you may already put up there, which identify some particular points in relation to the guide for actuaries.
I'm Sarah Matheson. I'm policy manager at the actuarial profession, but I'm a life actuary by background. The comment I've probably got about the guide is that it talks about sort of reconciling conflicts of interest, mm-hmm. and showing that they can be reconciled. And there's a couple of other examples around sort of policy and procedures. And I felt it wasn't so much about whether something could be reconciled or you've got the policies or procedures in the background doing what they're meant to be doing, but actually what the perception is and how it's perceived by the outside world. So there wasn't so much about, you know, it might be that the conflict is, you know, conflict of interest is, you know, being dealt with behind the scenes, but it's making sure that that the perception and how it would be perceived outside is being picked up appropriately.
So do you think that the guide could put more emphasis on not only is it ensuring that the conflict is avoided, but demonstrating that it's been avoided? Is that what it's showing?
Yes, and how it would appear to a layperson looking in. And probably looking more at some of the sort of case study examples where it, you know, sort of is quite procedural in how the different parties have gone about reconciling a conflict and saying they've done that, but it's more about, well, how would that be perceived by the outside world? They've gone through this procedure, but does it actually still look like there's still a conflict of interest?
Yeah. Thank you. That's a helpful comment which we'll take away.
Okay.
We will welcome any comments on the specific case study or examples that are in the guide. It's quite difficult to prepare them, actually. And so any thoughts that anybody has about, you know, improving them will be very gratefully received. Okay, any points on the guide for trustees? Anybody wants to make? Alan, did you have any points as a trustee yourself?
Alan Martin again, with perhaps one exception, i.e. those trustees who are actuaries. I think all actuaries should probably recognise that in 99%+ of situations, what the actuary recommends will happen. the advice of the actuary in practice, I think, is really, really significant, and the actuarial profession should not be under any illusions that what the actuary says generally gets done. And my example for that is the miners principles. When the follow-up investigation on that was done for investment advice, trustees were recorded as saying, if our investment consultant said jump off the cliff, we would jump off a cliff. I would say it's even stronger for the scheme actuary advice, so don't be under any illusions as to what's going to happen in practice.
Interesting.
Did you find the guide do you think it's of potential value, the guide for trustees?
Yes.
You do? Right, that's helpful. John, you were indicating.
Thank you, yes. John Thorne, Professional Oversight Board. You mentioned there, in terms of one of the questions on the guide, the importance of peer review. I'm interested to know what the working group felt of the recommendation that we made back in May 2009 that would prohibit advice to separate parties unless there's a robust independent review of their work, whether that was something you did look at as an option, and whether you know what conclusion you reached on it.
Graham, would you like to?
Yes, we did. We did consider the point, and in a sense, I think the comment this refers to that's in the guide is actually saying that that's something to be thought about. We considered it and we decided that we shouldn't make it a rule that under certain conditions you had to have an independent peer review. But in dealing with situations where there is a potential conflict of interest and in reconciling them, one of the ways in which you might choose to reconcile a conflict of interest and demonstrate that it was reconciled, when perhaps that wouldn't otherwise be the case, would be to make sure that there's a greater degree of independence in the peer review than otherwise would have been the case. And that's what that's getting at. So it does tie in with that comment, but it's true to say that in considering it, we didn't say, oh yes, we'll adopt that as a definite rule.
I think it's also fair to say, John, that the question of the profession's approach to peer review is under consideration not only in the context of the conflict of interest exercise. For example, in the pensions area, Graham is leading a group which is looking at the replacement of or the production of a new version of APSP2. And is looking at the issue of peer review from first principles in that context. Last week, I was involved with Ben and others in a meeting with the General Insurance Pensions Executive Committee, who are similarly concerned about the approach to peer review for the general insurance sector. In fact, one of the things we're going to do as a result of that is try and encourage a dialogue between the various, the general insurance, the pensions, the life and so on people, to see whether in fact there's a common, there are common strands which we need to be developing and to enable a sharing of thinking across the different sectoral areas in which the profession operates. So we are not just approaching the issue of peer review in this context. It's one of more general application and relevance, if you like. Did you want to follow up your query? Did I see you reach for the mic?
I think your further explanation there covered that point. I mean, certainly it's an area where we place great store on the view of users, and you mentioned the actuarial user committee that we have. And peer review is another area of particular concern for them, where their assumption was that it would be independent, whereas it is independent in a sense, but the view was that it would be external to the firm, which obviously present is generally not the case. So it is a related issue, as you say, and one that you're taking forward separately.
There's an issue, as you realise, there's a major question around cost, addition to cost. If you require external peer review, you immediately banging costs up for trustees and others. So there's a question about how far you, you know, where again, where to strike the balance, where the balance of advantage lies. Okay, it's, I mean, a topic which we will no doubt, I'm sure, confident that we will return to with the POB and others in the future.
Yeah,
can we move on from, I think, if we've dealt with any comments on the guide for trustees, we move on to the, just a brief word about the Actuaries Code. We're not proposing any specific amendments to the code at this point. In fact, in the responses to the consultation, we had a very positive endorsement of the approach taken in the code, and in particular, it's principle three, I think, of the five key principles that are articulated in the code. We did, however, in the working party, identify two specific issues which we are planning to have addressed as part of a separate code review, which is will take place next year. We don't envisage that this will be a fundamental review of the code. It's just going to be a light touch review in the light of experience of its working. We've only, by that point, it will have been in force for 3 years. It'll be the right moment to just say, well, how's it going on? Are there areas of lacking clarity in it? You know, things we could spell out, but we're not spell out better, but we're not looking to a fundamental reformulation of the code at that point. However, we will take account in that working party code review of those two points which are at the bottom there of that slide, which is now on the screen. Okay. Right, that then I think brings me just to mention the remaining element in the package, which is additional professional guidance. There's a strong demand from members for more CPD and training provision. I just want to give you an assurance that we will address that as part of the wholesale revision of our professionalism training and CPD provisions, which is currently underway. We haven't got down to designing the precise CPD provision on conflicts yet, because we want to be clear about precisely what the proposals are that we're going to actually bring into effect, so that we can design the CPD provision appropriately. But I just want to give you the assurance that there will be more training and so on, and revised and I hope considerably improved training in this area as a result of the of this working party's activities. Any comments on CPD and training? No. Right, okay. And that brings us, I think, to where we go next. First of all, we've got some final consultation questions. I should say that in response to the... I think we've picked up your comments on the practical implications of the proposals as we've gone through. We have, in relation to the second question on the slide there, we have met representatives of smaller firms, and we've got a meeting, another meeting in the offing with them shortly, both the ACEA smaller firms group and also the new smaller firms member interest group of the actuarial profession itself. So I think all that remains for me to do is to invite any other comments or reflections you might want to make on the package as a whole. And I'll then invite any members of the panel who haven't spoken or wish to speak to add any final thoughts. Any comments or questions? No? Okay, anything from the panel? No?
Well, I'd better add my tuppence worth on the principle that just to prove I can get the CPD that I was actually here. But I'm quite happy that I think the sort of committee has come up with what I think is a workable solution, speaking as a pensions actually. I think they've steered a reasonable middle course, and I'm reliably informed that on page 3 of the trustees' guidance I'm not the Alan in the scheme actually.
Well, it's good to have that clarification.
Who told you that?
Okay, well, look, thank you from us for your attendance this evening. We do value your input. Just a word about next step. You will get and can claim CPD for your attendance at this meeting. And please make sure that you sign the form to show that you attended on your way out of the building if you haven't done so already. The consultation period on the document closes on the 10th of December. Following that, we will be, of course, reflecting on the various points that have been made in the course of the consultation as a whole. We'll be reviewing not only the comments we get from members, but from the POB, from other key interested parties, and we will be producing final recommendations in the new year for probable implementation in the second quarter of 2012. That's the kind of timescale we're aiming for, and we will make very clear, of course, to members exactly where we end up and what is expected of them as we get towards that point. So again, my thanks to you, and it's been a genuine pleasure to be here in McLaurin House and to have a good discussion among such a select and elite number.
Thank you very much.